Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have been privileged in the course of hosting this program for almost 10 years now to have come across a lot of interesting people and to have an opportunity to present them to you, our audience. One of the most interesting, and all the more so because of her rather young age, is our first guest. Her name is Kaylee Long. She is the Chief Executive Officer of Terra Nexum. It is a lobbying firm that works on behalf of people suffering overseas, various predations. She is, among other things, a student nearing completion of her master's degree at one of my favorite institutions, the Institute of World Politics. She has been a regular speaker for the Leadership Institute, and I happened to catch her at the press conference that a remarkable group of women, they call themselves the Middle East Women's Coalition, put together at the National Press Club a few weeks ago, and I was simply blown away by Kaylee and her articulateness, her poise, and the importance of her message about what she has personally confronted in places like Syrian refugee camps and Lebanon in the recent past in connection with some work she did over there. So, Kaylee Long, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It is so good to have you with us, and thank you for standing up for those who are being victimized by Sharia supremacism.
Thank you, Mr. Gaffney. It's my honor.
So I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things, and maybe just by way of introduction, round out that personal experience that you've had, I gather, teaching English in Lebanon and the exposure that that gave you to Sharia in some of these refugee camps on the Syrian side of that border.
Yeah. Well, I went to the Middle East for the first time in March of last year, and I was in Zahri, which is on the border of Syria. So the school that I was teaching at was just right across the mountain pass from Syria. So just miles from us, they were still bombing over there, and the refugees would come over the mountain, and we would go into the camps, and we would offer to teach the children for free. But we made it very clear that I'm a Christian, and so we would be teaching them the Bible in addition to other educational skills like reading and math. I would say it was an eye-opening experience in the fact that I had never seen the horrors of Sharia and Islamic oppression to the extent that I saw it in Lebanon. However, I did witness it here in the U.S. At a younger age, and that is what troubles me so deeply. It's heartbreaking that that this oppression is happening globally, but what really disappoints me is that it's happening here in America. And as as Reagan alluded to, I mean, we are the city on a shining hill. If we don't have our stand of freedom here, where will it be?
Tell me a little bit about that, because this is of great concern to me. What are you referring to in terms of what you experienced in terms of Sharia here in the United States?
Yeah. So one of my first experiences of witnessing it was I was very young and I was in a shopping mall, and there was a young Pakistani girl who was selling cell phones at a cell phone booth. And I just felt moved by my God and my faith to go speak to this girl. And I developed a friendship with her, and I would go visit her very often in the shopping mall. And after we developed a friendship, after many months, she told me that she was scared of her father killing her. And I thought it was a joke or, you know, a euphemism. I didn't realize that she actually meant that she was scared of her father killing her until she stopped me and she said, I'm serious. And her crime was two things. One, I had been sharing the scripture with her. I had been sharing God's love with her. And she fearfully was entertaining that idea of Christ and his redemption. The second thing was she had taken a liking to another young Muslim man, but it was a man that she was not arranged to be married to. And that was a very severe crime. After a while, her uncle discovered us and she disappeared and I never heard from her again. So, and I have many other stories.
Yeah, this is the phenomenon of can result in honor killing in the Sharia traditions. And I pray that that did not befall your friend. One of the other things that was very much a feature of the press conference that you all did with the Middle East Women's Coalition was a warning to Americans about another manifestation of Sharia. It's not exclusively Sharia related, but predominantly it is, namely female genital mutilation. This is a problem, particularly, Kaylee Long, as you know, because a federal judge recently decided that a statute that had been on the federal books for over two decades, since 1996, was unconstitutional. And it's now, unbelievably, absolutely legal in 22 states across this country to engage in the mutilation of even little girls' genitals. Talk a little bit about that and why we should be determined to prevent that sort of thing from happening in America as well as elsewhere.
Well, first, it's not a minor issue. It's a major issue. I believe more than 500,000 girls right now in America are at risk for, I think it's 513,000 to be exact. And so I want to just comment, though, on not only why it's disastrous and harmful just because of the physical implications of it, but it is the foremost display of what a woman means in the Sharia culture. And that is something that is subjugated, inferior, and second class. And the reason I say that, I have a very dear friend who was forced to be married when she was 14 years old. She now works for the president. She's from Iraq. Wonderful young woman. But she told me, she said, Kaylee, when I grew up in Iraq, I hated that I was a woman. I hated my femininity. I hated it. There are some sects of Islam, the Salafi and Wahhabi sects, which will teach that women don't get to go to heaven. You have to do an outstanding act of service to Allah in a way that a man wouldn't have to do to maybe get a chance at going to heaven.
Like engaging in jihad, for example, martyrdom.
Yes. And so, so what I think FGM is before, because I remember hearing girls saying that they wanted FGM, and I thought, how is a girl so brainwashed that she's asking for that? And it hit me, like, these women have been trained to hate themselves. They're so hated that they now hate themselves, and FGM is the display of that.
Kaylee Long, beautifully said. We have to leave it at that for the moment, but I hope you'll come back to us for a longer conversation about this. God bless you, and look forward to hearing more about your work at Terra Nexum. Next up, we will speak with Michael Cutler. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Michael Cutler. He is a career professional in the business of securing the American people from enemies foreign, well, principally foreign, but some trying to become domestic, that's for sure. He worked for some 30 years in a variety of important positions in the Immigration and Naturalization Service, really the front lines of our defenses at the border. He has been incredibly thoughtful and articulate about the challenges that we're currently facing, some of which were addressed extraordinarily powerfully, I thought, last night by President Donald Trump in his first Oval Office address to the nation. A very brief speech, only 9.5 minutes, but one that I thought extremely effectively articulated what's at stake in terms of our border insecurity at the moment and why we find ourselves in the midst of a government, partial government shutdown over the case. Michael Cutler is, among other things, a man you can hear on his own radio program, the Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk Radio. You can also find his writings frequently at Front Page Magazine and elsewhere. It's great to have you back. Michael, Happy New Year to you, sir. Welcome.
Happy New Year to you, Frank. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, thank you for your service to our country, which continues to this day. We're very appreciative, even after you've retired from the INS, to continue working to help illuminate, as I say, the public safety crisis, as you've recently put it at Front Page Magazine. Talk a little bit about the president's speech as you heard it, and what were the most important takeaways as you see them?
Well, first of all, I've wanted him to do this for the longest time. Instead of tweeting, I've said consistently that he needs to get in front of the cameras, not with reporters, but just have a conversation with America. I wish he had done that over the so-called travel ban, which was actually an entry restriction based on standing law that was used by many other administrations, including that of Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush, and Obama. But yesterday, I thought he hit the ball out of the park, but he missed one crucial point, and it frustrated me. He neglected to speak about the nexus between open borders and terrorism because Latin America is a hotbed for radical Islamic terrorists. It's a hotbed for Hezbollah, which is a terror group sponsored, funded, directed by the government of Iran, which has increasingly been showing anger and frustration because President Trump properly took us out of that ridiculous deal over the nuclear weapons that put Iran on a trajectory to acquire them. Perhaps as soon as within a decade or earlier. And they have threatened, and I wrote about it for Front Page, they've threatened to send us, as they put it, refugees, bombs, terrorists, and assassination. So that border is extremely dangerous, needs to be secured. That was the only shortcoming that I heard in the speech, not making that nexus clear to the American people. Other than that, I thought he nailed it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the terrorism bit, because I thought that was striking, too. I've heard commentators suggest that he chose not to because the administration has become somewhat embroiled in the suggestion that there are terrorists coming across the border and then been hectored over evidence that there have been relatively few apprehensions. I share your concern about this. And not least, there's an issue, just one last point, Michael Cutler. There's a very strong concern about Hezbollah collaborating with the drug cartels, among other things, in the building of tunnels under the border, which is a whole nother kettle of fish.
And Hezbollah has been doing that, of course, throughout Israel. So they've demonstrated their prowess and their increasing capabilities of doing this. But let's go back to another case, and then we'll get to Hezbollah. There's a Pakistani by the name of Sharafat Ali Khan worth talking about. He is a citizen of Pakistan. He went to Latin America, set up shop in Brazil. Now, Brazil is significant, and I don't know that there's direct evidence that he was involved with the tri-border region of Brazil. But the tri-border region of Brazil, where Brazil abuts with Argentina and Paraguay, is a hotbed for terror training camps, primarily Hamas, Hezbollah, probably ISIS and Al-Qaeda as well. And once he established residency in Brazil, he began smuggling men from the Middle East, from terror-sponsoring countries, into Latin America and then up into the United States at an extremely high cost. You have to wonder who was footing the bill. And one of the men, according to a Washington Times article identified by a review of the charging documents in this federal case, was an individual who was a citizen of Afghanistan who was said to be involved in a plot to conduct attacks in the United States or Canada and had family ties to members of the Taliban. So here we have a guy going into Brazil, bringing in men from the Middle East, terror-sponsoring countries, smuggling them into the United States. So that's not even Hezbollah. That's a Pakistani operating as part of a large-scale smuggling operation. But if you look at some of the articles that I've recently written, what you're talking about, this concern about the nexus between Hezbollah and the trafficking of illegal aliens and terrorists is a huge problem. So let me read two quick paragraphs. There was a congressional hearing on April 17th of this past year by the House Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. And one of the witnesses, Emmanuel Otsolange of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, provided graphic testimony that none of the other witnesses refuted, by the way, even the witness provided by the Democrats. So this is very significant. Let me read this to you. In recent years, Hezbollah's Latin American networks have also increasingly cooperated with violent drug cartels and criminal syndicates, often with the assistance of local corrupt political elites. Cooperation includes the laundering of drug money, arranging multi-ton shipments of cocaine to the United States and Europe, and directly distributing and selling illicit substances to distant markets. Proceeds from these activities finance Hezbollah's arms procurement, its terror activities overseas, its hold on Lebanon's political system, and its efforts both in Lebanon and overseas to keep Shia's communities loyal to its cause and complicit in its endeavors. And this is the real punchline to this. This is the real takeaway. This toxic crime terror nexus is fueling both the rising threat of global jihadism and the collapse of law and order across Latin America that is helping to drive drugs and people northward into the United States. It is sustaining Hezbollah's growing financial needs. It is helping Iran and Hezbollah consolidate a local constituency in multiple countries across Latin America. It is thus facilitating their efforts to build safe havens for terrorists and a continent-wide terror infrastructure that they could use to strike U.S. targets. That's about as crystal clear as it gets.
It is. It is. And one of the reasons why I think you're right in the critique that the administration needs to continue making that case, and I think it is in other places, but there was an opportunity to do so in the president's address. And let me ask you about one other piece of this, if I can, Michael Cutler. We're talking about, in addition to the violence that is perpetrated by some of those coming across our border, and it's in addition to what terrorists might seek, it is those drug traffickers, it is those criminal cartels and gang members and the like as well. There's also another piece to this, which you have talked with me about in the past, but it's also not getting the attention I think it deserves, and that is the public health concerns arising from people coming here in large numbers, many of them unwell, certainly unwell as a result of their ordeal in getting here, but in many cases as well, having some kind of disease. Sometimes it's an exotic one. Sometimes it's just a particularly insidious one, like tuberculosis. Talk about that problem, if you would, too.
Sure. You know, it's ironic. But, you know, and by the way, when you listen to Schumer talking about, oh, we don't need a wall, it's ineffective, and Pelosi saying that it's immoral. Remember, the wall wouldn't stop anybody from entering the United States legally. It's not that we're going to block off ports of entry. It would just funnel all traffic through ports of entry so that all of the people can be inspected, in part looking for evidence of disease. You know, at the beginning of my career, I spent 4 years as an inspector at Kennedy Airport and got a very nice letter when a child who was running an extremely high fever was semi-conscious in my booth at Kennedy Airport. I immediately notified my superiors. They called for an ambulance, and this child would have died had we not gotten the child medical care immediately. They rushed the child to a hospital. Turns out that it wasn't even the parents bringing the kid here. So when you bring a disease into a country, you provide an opportunity for the disease to start an epidemic, because if it's a disease that we're no longer inoculating people from because we thought we vanquished it, or it's a disease we've never seen before coming from some exotic locations, let's remember that Ellis Island was a quarantine station. And meanwhile, you have Schumer saying, well, the symbol of America shouldn't be a 30-foot-high wall, but it should be the Statue of Liberty. Let's remember that attached to the Statue of Liberty was Ellis Island, the largest quarantine station in the United States at the time.
from which large numbers of people were deported, as I recall, because they were plaguing with tuberculosis or what have you.
Whether they would bring disease or whether they were physically fit to support themselves, everyone glosses over that part of it also, by the way.
Another key point. Hey, two quick questions for you before we run out of time, Michael Cutler. One is that there's some caviling taking place now on the part of Democrats that when the president points, as he did, I thought, quite effectively yesterday to the violence that is coming across that southern border in the form of narcotics and fentanyl and other deadly drugs. They say, well, it's not coming across the border through, you know, these coyotes smuggling. It's coming right through those ports of entry. A wall won't do anything about that. In your experience, Michael, do you agree with this fellow Mark Morgan, who formerly ran the Border Patrol for Barack Obama, that a wall does work?
Yeah, look, I call it the immigration colander. Today, if someone gets into the United States and they yell political asylum, they're basically home free for as long as they want to be, and then they disappear into the woodwork. The idea is to prevent the entry in the first place.
We are just hard out of time. Michael Cutler, as usual, we have much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back for a longer visit in the very near future. But in the meantime, thank you. Next up, we will be speaking with Diana West about the president's speech and more right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, now very distinguished blogger and best-selling author. You can find her works these days at dianawest.net and also at Amazon and your favorite bookstore, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, who are two terrific books. A shortly forthcoming monograph from the Center for Security Policy about the red thread to the Trump collusion narrative. We'll look forward to talking about that soon. But Diana West, in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back. And, well, I think congratulations are in order to all of us America First types, because the president made what seemed to me to be a very, very important America First address to the nation from the Oval Office last night. Your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. This was exactly what he had to say, the way he had to say it. And he really put the policy out there for Americans to look at and then contrast it with the Democratic response. The fact that the Democrats would respond to an Oval Office address, I don't know if that's unprecedented, but this was not a State of the Union. It was a very strange kind of dynamic that they set up with their sort of creepy duo, sort of American Gothic style stance. But I think that the fact that this was so politicized by the Democrats in making that response goes right to the heart of this. And I really want to ask people to think about something. Do you think that the Democrats would be doing everything in their power to keep the border open, to keep a wall away, a fence, a border, some kind of physical barrier on this open wound that we have in our southern side, if the people coming across en masse were not expected to vote in the Democratic camp? In other words, if these immigrants would naturalize at some point or be amnestied at some point or be illegally brought into the voting system and voting for free markets and limited government, would they be sitting there keeping the wall open?
No, I think it would be pretty clearly a threat to national security. They would insist on shutting down right away.
We know that Hispanics generally will vote 75% or higher on the Democratic ticket, whether immigration is an issue or not. So I think that's a very important thing to keep at the back of our minds when we understand how they're politicizing our national security and further tolerating the kind of carnage that comes with this lawlessness. I mean, that, I think, is the really grotesque aspect to this.
You know, a couple of things come to my mind. One, Diana, this may sound as though that's a nakedly partisan critique of what the Democrats have done, but I'm reminded of an acknowledgement by one of Tony Blair's lieutenants, the former prime minister in the UK, after Blair had left office, of course, but he nonetheless admitted that Tony Blair had pursued what amounted to open borders policies in the UK for the purpose of changing the electorate. He was very deliberately doing it, and it does seem as though that's at work here too, is it not?
Well, it is. It is at work here. It's not only voting. There is an Uber ideology that goes to this that we are seeing in Europe, in England, and across Europe, in terms of transforming a demographic at this point, we can discuss European nations as the indigenous peoples of Europe who are being demographically transformed into multi-ethnic, multi-religious societies that are no longer cultures as they have evolved over the millennia. I mean, this is a policy we've discussed over many, many years now. It's all of a piece, and the pain and suffering brought by these mass migrations, as we've seen, you know, vividly lived, experienced by Europeans, by little people, quote unquote, is absolutely of no interest or concern of these elite leaders. And that is where you see the sort of synergy between Schumer and Pelosi and the European Union. I would even extend it to what we were looking at when we had a particularly high troop concentration in Afghanistan, where the policy, the alliance with our Afghan allies, quote unquote, was so important that it didn't matter that we were bringing a murder rate to our war fighters literally on a par with what you will see in Central America. I mean, this is I've crunched the numbers. This actually is what we were looking at when we were experiencing the outbreak of what they called blue on green murder, the inside the wire murders of our war fighters. And this was a scandal that did not matter to the elites governing it at the highest levels of the Pentagon and the White House and so on, all of a piece.
It's a very interesting point. Let me come back to something that you said, though, because you talked about the carnage and the humanitarian costs or toll on the native populations, whether it's the result of the Hydra, as it's called in Europe, or whether it's a result of the mass migration across our southern border in this country. I was struck by one of the themes that the president clearly wanted to convey to the American people last night, and that is the toll that's being taken on the migrants themselves, that there's a humanitarian consideration here that argues for dissuading them from coming here in the first place because of what's being done to them in the process of coming here or as a result of their making this trek. Speak to that point, too, because it seemed to me this was really taking out of the Democrats' hands this, you know, argument that they've got the corner on the compassion market to the extent they express any at all. It's for the migrants, not for the Americans, of course.
Right. No, these are always, people are beans and counters to the left. I mean, this is something we can just document over a century at least. And you can say that, make the same case about the migrants as the president did in terms of looking at the cost to women and children who make this trek, lured by all kinds of promises and lures to come here to the land of milk and honey, putting children on this arduous trip that in itself is a form of child abuse, you can argue, in terms of putting them at risk, the rape, the malnutrition, the exposure. I mean, it's absolutely horrendous in terms of just solely a humanitarian rubric.
Just to say nothing of the danger of being trafficked by these cartels.
The trafficking and the drug costs. But I think that the president's, where he really speaks to it in terms of making the case for the cost on both sides of the border in humanitarian terms. And then he comes back to the theme, which I think really is the most compelling line, which is the notion that walls don't mean you hate the people on the other side. It means you love the people on the inside. I think that this is really is what separates him and America First and the notion of preserving our nation from not just the left, but the sort of liberalized right as well, whereby getting back to the idea of existing as a nation as opposed to being just a region of the globe, which is, again, where we've been moving, really, certainly since World War II, uninterruptedly.
Let me just emphasize, Dana, that people listening to this, just so we're clear, you're not talking about maintaining some kind of white racial character to the nation. You're talking about maintaining the nation as a civilization, as a culture, as a nation governed by the rule of law. And that seems to me to be one of the things that's really going largely unaddressed here, is there's a sort of nihilism that is a function of essentially jettisoning the law and the requirement that people adhere to it. And with it, ultimately, inevitably, goes the Constitution and, you know, our form of political governance and all the rest, doesn't it?
Well, it does. It is a civilization that is descended from, we have to apologize for it, but it is white people came here and settled. Black people were brought here as slaves. We really begin as a biracial nation. There's no racial purity, quote unquote, to preserve. And certainly we have been a tremendously fascinating and enriched experience of many different nationalities coming here, predominantly from Europe and predominantly an Anglo-Saxon culture, Anglo-Saxon law, coming down from the Magna Carta to the Constitution. I mean, this is the culture and civilization and law that evolved here that will be destroyed, transformed, and lost with an influx of nationalities, peoples, ethnicities who tend toward the socialism. And I think this gets to the point where the socialist policies that the Democratic Party stand for do not win with Americans, and they are actually importing populations at this point to support these kinds of corrupt redistributive schemes. I mean, that is essentially what we are looking at. So is it a racial issue? No. Is it a constitutional issue at heart? Yes. This is how we've evolved, and there is a desperate moment where we may or may not be able to preserve it. Demographics are destiny, and so yes, this has to be considered. Again, getting back to this notion, we know that the Democrats wish to import populations that will support them, having lost the battle over the century with Americans. And that's kind of what we're looking at. And it's very scheming, very nefarious, very ugly. And again, of a piece with what is going on again with our cousins in Europe. I mean, this is kind of what we're looking at.
Talk very briefly, if you would, Diana, about what the president should do now, having made this case directly to the American people.
Well, I think he has to hold firm. I think that, you know, this has to go forward. If it is, you know, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I, you know, the state of emergency is certainly an option. The military aspects of enforcing this, of making this a reality. I think that he has to continue getting this message out and continue hammering the fact that the Democrats are mainly all on board with the same policy that they've now switched.
From your lips to God's ears is all I can say. Diana West, thank you for all that you do to help carry the day at dianawest.net. We appreciate you so much and look forward to talking with you again next week.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is my personal privilege and great delight to have with us for this segment an old and very cherished friend and colleague who has distinguished himself over some 25 years as the president of an extraordinarily important organization in America, the Zionist Organization of America. It is better known by its acronym ZOA, and its leader for all those years has been Morton Klein. We were honored as an organization, the Center for Security Policy, that is, in 2016, to recognize Mort Klein's long and extraordinary service to our country, as well as to Israel and to American Jewry in the role of president of the Zionist Organization of America with our highest award, our Keeper of the Flame recognition. And Mort has gone on in the years since he received that award in 2016 to earn it all over again many times. He's come in for a little bit of criticism over the years, and some of it from within the ranks of American Jewry, I'm sorry to say. But we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on within that community, and notably the seeming growth of the phenomenon of, well, some call it anti-Zionism. I think of it as anti-Semitism, masquerading as the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS movement. Mort Klein, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's been far too long. We're very grateful to having you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you so much, Frank. And I am frequently called, you may not know, as the Frank Gaffney of the Jewish world.
Well, I'm honored. I don't know about you, but thank you, Mort. Well, listen, before we get to some of the internal struggles within American Jewry at the moment, I did want to talk about this legislation that I know ZOA was very supportive of that seems, at least for the moment, to have run into a bit of swampish constipation, if I could mix my metaphor there. Marco Rubio's effort aimed at combating this BDS business. In the Senate yesterday, it fell short of the required 60 votes to be taken up and considered by the full Senate. What's going on there, Mort? And specifically, is do you agree with the concern Marco Rubio has expressed that increasingly this BDS phenomenon seems to be gaining traction and adherence in, well, among other places, the Democratic Caucus of the United States Senate?
Well, it was deeply troubling to see that only 3 of 47 Democrats voted for this bill. 3 of 47. Well, I believe all of 53 Republicans voted for this bill to penalize those who promote boycotting Israel. And you should also understand it's not a freedom of speech issue. It simply says if businesses boycott Israel, America won't do business with them. They can still condemn Israel, attack Israel, hate Jews, hate blacks, hate anybody they want, that we simply won't do business with them. So it's not a freedom of speech issue. And in my discussions with people on the Hill, one of the main reasons many people, many Democrats who supported this bill did not want to have a vote on it, this bill to come to a specific vote, was because so many Democrats were going to vote against it. And they didn't want to be exposed that painfully, a party that was once extraordinarily pro-Israel has now gained many adherents who are very hostile to Israel, including 3 new members of Congress, who for the first time we now have members of Congress openly anti-Semitic, openly calling to stop aid to Israel, openly having in their offices removing Israel from their maps, openly accusing Israel supporters and Jews as dual loyalists, while they themselves wrap themselves in a Palestinian flag when they're inducted into the Congress.
Mort, this is such an important point. And, you know, years ago, had the privilege of working for a Democrat in the United States Senate who was renowned for his commitment to the Jewish people and to the state of Israel, namely Henry Scoop Jackson of Washington State. And all I can say is I can only imagine the high RPM that he's spinning at in his grave as we see what's happening to the Democratic Party. It's not, unfortunately, just these radical members in the House, but apparently significant numbers in the Senate as well. And I think this must reflect at some level what's happening within the Democratic Party more generally, is it not? And could you talk a little bit about sort of what's happening on college campuses, what's happening in synagogues and Jewish organizations, notably the Anti-Defamation League, once a rather important bulwark against anti-Semitism, now it seems in the thrall of anti-Semites, and J Street and, you know, Soros's other creatures, for example?
Well, we're living in a time of frightening, increasingly unbridled anti-Semitism and Israel hatred. Our campuses now have an onslaught of BDS boycotters promoting that type of legislation. They publicly have rallies, believe it or not, calling for Jews to get off our campuses, for even to kill Jews. It's hard to believe. They actually call for the murder of Jews at their rallies. And that's Students for Justice in Palestine. We get calls every week from students who are beaten up or punched by people because they're Zionists, because they support Israel. And, of course, we now have had a horrific massacre at a Pittsburgh synagogue of 11 Jews. It's in Israel, we still have stabbings and murders of Jews regularly by Palestinian Arabs. And Congress and the media are allowing this to go on without any strong condemnation. We're really seeing, for the first time, a mainstreaming and legitimizing of anti-Semitism. It is truly frightening. And we have condemned the Anti-Defamation League for promoting and praising anti-Israel, anti-Semitic groups like Black Lives Matter, who is really against Israel's very existence. They praise them. They praise J Street, an anti-Israel organization. They co-sign letters, ADL does, with CARE and MPAC, two viciously anti-Israel Muslim organizations, legitimizing them. And they condemn pro-Israel groups like Act for America and Frank Gaffney's own Center for Security Policy. Our best friends, ADL, condemns them. So we have publicly condemned them for this and condemned Hayas and National Council of Jewish Women for defending Linda Sarsour, an outright anti-Semite. And because we've condemned them very strongly, not calling them names and not cursing or anything of that nature, just strongly condemning them, the Conference of Presidents of major American Jewish organizations, the umbrella group of the 50 Jewish organizations, have warned us to stop harshly condemning ADL and Hayas and National Council of Jewish Women. Hayas was an organization that used to bring large numbers of Jews to America. Now only 4% of the people they bring to America are Jews. The large proportion of them that they bring to America are Muslims. So we've been warned not to criticize them harshly, but in the time of unbridled anti-Semitism, we have to be very strong in our condemnations of what's going on. And we are really shocked that we were warned, while the organizations who have publicly condemned us, COA, and claim that we don't fight anti-Semitism and claim that our Zionism promotes violence, complete lies, they dismissed our complaints against them. It's really a very disturbing situation.
I am really struck that the organization of which you speak, the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, has not recognized what a mortal threat to the Jewish people these kinds of, well, anti-Semitic vehicles are to, you know, even the lives of Jews. So I commend you for what you're doing, needless to say. But can you just explain what seems to be going on in the minds of the leadership of this conference?
Well, I'm afraid there's a piece of the way the Jews responded in the 30s and 40s. When you had there's no comparison to what's going on today, but when you had the horrors of what's going on in Europe, the Jewish leaders were telling other Jewish leaders to keep quiet, shut up, say nothing. You'll only make things worse. You'll only increase anti-Semitism. And now I'm afraid too many Jewish leaders have really become frightened appeasers, afraid to speak out, thinking if we speak out against our enemies, we'll only make them more angry, more vicious, and make things worse. This is simply a fear, and that has led to appeasement, and that is why they've criticized ZOA for criticizing the Linda Sarsours publicly and other anti-Semites publicly and strongly, because they're afraid we'll make things worse. Imagine Hayas, National Council of Jewish Women, pleading, stop criticizing Linda Sarsour. Sarsour, who's an open anti-Semite, who promotes violence against Jews, and when it comes to BDS legislation, ADL is in state after state fighting us to stop anti-BDS legislation.
Mort Klein, thank you so much for your time today, as well as for the extraordinary service you've rendered to our country over decades at the Zionist Organization of America. I know you'll keep it up. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, and that the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.